From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. William Kittredge was born into the myth of the American West, growing up on an Oregon cattle ranch. But in his 30s, Kittredge started to see the West as a dreamland gone wrong. He sold the ranch and turned to writing. On today's Fresh Air, William Kittredge looks for the true story of the American West. We also examine the rise and fall of the pulp detective magazine with writer Ron Gollart. The pulps were the first home of the hard-boiled detective and published the first work of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. And we have reviews of recent recordings of the music of Elliot Carter and of Barry Fleming's 1973 novel, The Make-Believers, which has just been brought out in a new edition. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Writer William Kittredge grew up on a cattle ranch in the West, in Oregon. His grandparents were pioneers. He grew up with the myth that the white settler owned the West, absolutely and morally. They brought law and order to the West, shed blood to settle it, and it was rightfully theirs. But as Kittredge got older, he realized that this myth ignores the genocide of the Native Americans and ignores the ways in which many whites destroyed the ecology of the land they settled. In the American West, Kittredge says, we are struggling to revise our dominant mythology. William Kittredge is one of the writers at the forefront of that struggle. He sold his family cattle ranch in 1967 when he was in his mid-30s. He's since become a writer and a professor of English at the University of Montana. He writes about the myths of the American West and tries to tell the true story of the land where he grew up. He's even co-written a series of Western genre novels under the pseudonym of Owen Rountree. His latest collection of stories is titled We Are Not in This Together. His latest collection of essays is Owning It All. I asked him to read a paragraph from the title essay, Owning It All.
My father grew up on a homestead place on the Sagebrush Flats outside Silver Lake, Oregon. He tells of hiding under the bed with his sisters when strangers came to the gate. He grew up, as we all did in that country and era, believing that the one sure defense against the world was property. I was born in 1932 and recall a life before the end of World War II in which it was possible for a child to imagine that his family owned the world.
Can you elaborate on that feeling of owning it all, of owning the world?
Yes, I can. We lived in a place, Adel, Oregon, which at the time I grew up had no paved roads within about 50 miles. It had no power lines. We had an old Delco power plant, which we, you know, provided lights for the house. There was no telephone, and beyond us, at the end, we were the end of the road, essentially, from Warner Valley on at that time. There were wagon roads, and they didn't really go clear through the desert. It was 70 or 80 miles to any kind of habitation at all, where people lived on the great deserts beyond us. And as a consequence, we were extremely isolated, and we owned, you know, most of that valley. A few other people owned property in that valley, but we owned the lion's share of it, and in the BLM land, at that time it was Taylor grazing land, the government land beyond us for that 70 or 80 miles of high desert, we ran as if it was ours. And at that time, that was in the late 30s and early 40s, we essentially owned all the water out there. We owned 40 acres here and 40 acres there where there was a spring, so we treated all that property as if it were ours. And for a child growing up there, it was as if you owned the world. Everything in all directions was essentially yours. It was a great feudal kingdom, and there was really a sense of great security from the world and great isolation and great proprietorship.
Okay, great security and great isolation. Let's talk a little bit about the isolation. You were cut off from culture. I mean, aside from magazine subscriptions, you really didn't have access to probably some of the literature you're interested in, maybe movies.
Concerts. No, there was nothing like that. No movies. I can remember going to Eugene while I was, you know, this was years and years later when I was in my early 30s, going to Eugene and just going up there and watching movies for about 3 days. And I remember watching the first movie I'd seen in about 2.5 years was Dr. Zhivago. When I went to Eugene, and it just blew me out of the chair. You know, I couldn't believe this thing. I wept and screamed and, you know, so on and so forth. And it was a tremendous experience. I'd never seen a widescreen movie at that point. And books and that sort of thing were also, you know, there was no sense of any kind of literary community around you. When I left in 1967, a man who was a dear friend of mine came over to my to help me pack up and leave, and I had a lot of books, and we were putting all these books in boxes, and he looked at me at one point and said, you know, Bill, if you read all these things, you'd really be smart, wouldn't you? And I have no idea what he thought I was doing with all those books, you know, but but I really, you know, there was really no one that you to share those things with. It's true. The town where he lived, Adel, I once picked up a copy of Oregon Historical Names, and I saw the name Lonely, and I thought, my God, how would you like to live in a place called Lonely? And I looked down and said, former name of Adel, which was the place where I was living at the moment. So it was very isolated, yes.
You were heir to the ranch. Did you want to be the heir? Did that make you feel good?
Well, it was more complicated than that. It was a large family, and many of us were heir to it. We were third generation by my time, I was one of the principal heirs, certainly, and I was one of the people who stayed there. A lot of the heirs did not stay there and went off to other lives, and they clearly were less interested in preserving that property than I was. But yeah, it made me feel good in the sense that finally, once I got back on the ranch and once I understood how things were done and once I got to the point where I had jobs and had a lot of responsibility connected to it, then it was this great thing. I've said in the writing, it was the greatest plaything I ever had in my life, and I'm sure that's true. It was fun all day long for years to be able to manipulate, you know, land and water and crops and men and equipment and all this stuff. It was just like you were playing chess with the world in a sense, and it was a great challenge. But after a while, it began to also it ran out, and it became less interesting for one thing, and also. Began to see that in our manipulation of the world, the things we were doing to the land and the water and so on and so forth, we were destroying a lot of things. We thought at the time that we were, as I've said in the book, that we were doing God's work. We were making the world right. We were fixing it up. We were straightening it out. We were correcting God's errors, nature's errors, if you will. And of course, what we were doing was destroying the natural ecology of the place just as rapidly as we could go. And it was finally, after about 7 or 8 years, of the kind of work that I've talked about, we began to have all kinds of kind of man-made natural disasters. Suddenly, we killed off all the coyotes, poisoned them, shot them from airplanes, all kinds of things. Suddenly, we had a huge explosion of field mice that destroyed about 4,000 acres of alfalfa because all the natural predators were gone. Things of that nature just kept happening. Some of the prime peatland in the bottom of the valley, wonderful land, peat 8 feet deep, suddenly began to show signs of salinity. And we suddenly began to have to use fertilizer and begin to have to do all kinds of things to compensate for the mistakes that essentially we'd unknowingly made while we thought we were bringing the world, you know, right, while we thought we were straightening it up, making it perfect. I go back to that ranch now and drive around on it, and it looks pretty much the same as it did 20 years ago, 19 years ago when I left. People who've run it since haven't changed it very much, and it's okay. I'm delighted to see it the way it is, but I think I'd be much more delighted if we'd never touched it at all, if it were all still tule ground and swamps and the great rafts, you know, flights of V's of water birds were still coming in and out of there the way they were when I was a child.
William Kittredge is my guest, and his latest collection of essays is called Owning It All. You sold the ranch in 1967, and I was wondering if you felt guilty at all about selling it. In one of your essays, you say that there was a family rule, and the rule was, what's good for the property is good for you. So I imagine it was a very difficult decision to sell the property to somebody else.
Well, there was a lot of division in the family about that. Some of us had clearly gotten over that family rule by that time and no longer necessarily believed that. Others, I think, still held to that notion, but we had all by that time, I think, realized that an ethic that somehow, you know, establishes property as the primary thing in the life of a family is really going to be enormously divisive before it's over. When property becomes the primary thing on which you base everything else, including love and including, you know, various kinds of attachments and so forth, you're going to drive people apart before you're done. And that's what happened to us. And we ended up quite divided, I think. And everybody was relieved to make their getaway, I think, finally. At the end, it was simply, it had become by that point untenable because of that, of the nature of our relationships were all determined by what's good for the property, what's good for the property. I mean, if your marriage suffered a little bit, so you can patch up your marriage, you can't patch up the property. It was the general run of things and the way things were thought about in our family, I think, for the most part. And that's, you know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
When you sold the land, you went to the Iowa Writers Workshop. I guess you sold the land knowing that you wanted a different kind of life, that you wanted more time to write. How did you start writing?
Well, I went to college. I went to Oregon State College in Corvallis in the early 50s, late 40s and early 50s, and lucked into a class from Bernard Malamud, who had just published The Natural. And finally, they had him teaching four classes of comp, and finally they let him teach one class of creative writing. And I took the first class he taught there, and because I'd started reading some books, you know, that great explosion that happens sometimes to people. My junior year in college, I was this ranch kid, and I took a American literature class from a man named Herbert Childs and read Thoreau and Emerson and was just kind of vamped by all that stuff. And suddenly I thought, wow. And then I read Hemingway and I was just knocked out of my chair. And then I thought, when this guy Malamud got to teach a creative writing class, I thought, well, I'll take that. And I did. He and I didn't get along at all. I didn't want to write the kinds of stories that I now tell my students to write, which he was telling me to write. But he got me hooked. And I got out of college and I tried to write a little bit. And always, for the next 10 years when I wasn't writing, I thought I'd better write. This, you know, I kept thinking, you know, this eventually someday will be my life. And I was really kind of in emotional trouble at about the age of 32 when I said one day, in fact, it was the day after Thanksgiving, that I better sit down and do this if I'm ever going to do it, which I did. And that was about, I think, 64. And by the time we sold the ranch at 67, I had published two or three things and was pretty much convinced that I this really was the life I want. I got out of the ranch with enough money to either go to graduate school or get back in the ranch business in some limited way. And I chose to go to graduate school, and I've never regretted it. People say, don't you wish you were back on the ranch? You know, kind of, I think, reflecting the great romantic notion that most Americans have about that life. And all I can say is, nope, never for a moment. Do I wish I was back on the ranch? I always say, you know, if I was, I'd be feeding cows right now. And as a matter of fact, right at this moment while recording this program, had I not made that decision, I'd probably be out in Warner Valley pitching hay. I'm glad I'm here.
Well, I think your subject as a writer became reexamining the myths of the West and then writing the story of the West as it is now.
I really believe so. In other words, one of the things that I started with, as I say, we all believed we were doing God's work in fixing up the world and the world was there for our use and all of those, you know, common elements of the mythology of the American West. I believed that for a long time. I went through a real period of transition in the later years there at the ranch and even after I began to write, until I began to see that so many elements of that mythology had led us to make some terrible mistakes. At that point, I had to think my way through all that stuff and write my way through all that stuff until finally I came out at the far end, really thinking the mythology of the West, the Western, which is really a kind of America mythology, a mythology of conquest and takeover. I've described it as, you know, as a really racist, sexist, imperialist mythology that controlled, you know, most of America's conduct up until, say, the Second World War or after the Second World War, perhaps even up to the Vietnam War, was really an immoral mythology, and I really truly believe it was, and one that led to repression and genocide and misuse of the land. A lot of the ecological problems we've got now are a result of that. A great many of the problems we have today are a result of living by that mythology. Fortunately, it seems to me that's changing very rapidly. I'm in Seattle right now in a town which I think really believes a lot in ecology, and it's all over. You know, it's in the last 20 years, it's changed greatly, and suddenly we're beginning to see that we have to change. We have to tell ourselves a new story, and one of the things I really believe is that human conduct is mostly, you know, determined by the kinds of stories we tell ourselves and the kinds of stories we try to live out. And it seems to me that old story of the Western is a story that thank God we're learning to no longer try to live. We're learning to abhor it, and we're learning to try to live a new story, which is can be called something like stay home and take care of things rather than go out and conquer things. And that seems enormously important to me.
Let's talk about some of the old myths and some of the new stories after we take a short break. And my guest is William Kittredge, and his latest collection of essays is called Owning It All. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is essayist and fiction writer William Kittredge. He grew up on a cattle ranch, but sold it to become a writer and professor. Now he writes about the myths of the American West and the American West as it is today. His most recent books include Owning It All, a collection of essays, and The Last Best Place, which is an anthology of Montana writing, which he co-edited with Enoch Smith. He's also written a series of westerns under the pseudonym of Owen Rountree. Kittredge now lives in Montana, but he's joining us today from KUOW in Seattle. One of the myths that you've written about, you call this our enfranchising myth, the great Western myth of the holy and innocent hero coming from the wilderness into town to slay the dragon, and then he rides away like a movie star. That's now you actually write Westerns under the pseudonym of
I did for a while, yes.
Yeah. Was it to subvert that old myth in any way that you started writing the Westerns?
Well, I think a couple of, two or three things. It wasn't a completely pure impulse. I wrote it to make money, for one
course.
Thing. And another thing, I wrote it with someone else, a man named Stephen M. Krauser, who's a very fine writer himself. And we were really interested in writing a kind of new version of the Western in a way, kind of subverting it slightly. One of our heroes is a heroine, is a woman, gunfighter woman, if you will. And in fact, that series of books, the Cord novels, have been written about as self-reflexive Westerns, if you will, self-reflexive genre stories in which they begin to look at the genre itself and make the genre examine itself a little bit. And we were clearly pretty interested in doing that. They're very modernist Westerns, if you will. But at the same time, I think the primary impulse I had was really understanding the story. I felt like I had to write the things to understand how they worked, and it was a great help to me. It really was very revealing. We wrote 9 of them, and we finally quit writing them simply because we got tired, I think, because we felt we understood, you know, the genre and how it worked, and we're no longer interested in really, I guess, playing around with it anymore. It was fun to do for a while, and then it became labor, and at that point we quit.
You know, it seems to me that nowadays a lot of people want to trade myths. In other words, that you see a lot of Easterners who want to, like, live out the pioneer myths and go west and fit into maybe one of the myths that you left.
Oh, you sure do. You know, Montana's full of people who are coming out and buying property and building log houses and trying to plug into, you know, this mythology all the time. And you see Montanans immediately who think the hunting and fishing isn't any good anymore or whatever, or that things have, you know, become, I don't know, too corporate or something. They all want to move to Alaska or Australia, or I guess the last A would be Antarctica or someplace to escape, to get away. Sure, I believe that, you know, you're very correct.
Well, what's it like for you when you meet transplanted Easterners, for instance, coming to Montana and trying to enact out what might really be a fantasy of the West?
Well, you have to believe, one, that the fantasy's kind of silly. And you go down to some place like Jackson or Cody, and you see these people striding around in cowboy boots with big hats and silver buckles, and it's ridiculous, of course. On the other hand, you know, the upside of it, or the positive side of it, is that all these people are coming and have always come to try to find a home, to try to find a place where they can live a coherent life, and often in a place where they can live in some relationship to nature, to the natural world, which isn't completely, you know, skewed in some sort of way. There are many, you know, I think literally crazy manifestations of all this. There are a lot of survivalists, for instance, in Montana, who are not my favorite people in the world. They really want to set up barricades and you know, kind of hold guns on everybody who comes near them. That's clearly a lunatic response. But there are a lot of good people coming out to try to make their homes. Most of the people I know, not most of the people, but 2/3 of the people I know, the writers in Montana, are not natives. There are natives like Jim Welch and Ivan Doig and people like that, but there's so many others like Tom McGuane and Richard Hugo and myself who, you know, did not grow up in Montana. So it's really a mixed bag, but I don't think there's some great separation between inlanders and outlanders, essentially. We're all looking for a good home, you know.
You've written that regional art is the most important art because it's mostly the only art which is useful in our efforts to know ourselves. Do you think of your writing as a form of regional art?
Yeah, and, you know, there are lots of silly arguments about regional art and so on and so forth. Tom McGuane recently quoted Jim Harrison saying he wasn't even sure there was an American art. But I really believe, when I say regional art, I really believe that art that springs from a place, from a locality, from a set of mores and a bunch of people in some particular place is the only art that ever, for me, really works. And when you try to imagine a national art, for instance, the United States, and we end up with, I don't know what, television, I guess, or something. And clearly it becomes so amorphous, it's very hard to identify. You know, I don't know what a national art would be in this country, but I really do know what a variety of regional arts are, which I admire enormously. And the Northern Rockies, Northeast, Boston, it seems to me, has its own regional tenor. There couldn't be anything more regional, probably, than the Upper East Side of New York, you know, of Manhattan Island. Mm-hmm. Those are really regional, I think, and very specific, and create wonderful art because of it.
Well, you've written that the art of a region begins to come mature when it's no longer what we think it should be. And I'd like to know how you think that applies to your own writing.
Well, I think that in my own writing, I'm trying to explore things we're not, I think, the expected thing we would find written about. And I don't really think about it much in terms of my own writing. I'm not quite that self-conscious. In terms of other people's writing, I think of a novel like Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson, which I think is a wonderful book. And it's also a very Western book. It's written about Sandpoint, Idaho. Marilyn grew up in Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint. I think a book like that, which is a complete surprise, we would not have expected that book from a Westerner. Is a sign that the writing about the place is no longer in the hip pocket of the mythology. That book doesn't seem to have much to do with the mythology, one way or the other. I think a book, Certain Parts of a River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean, work in the same way. When he says in the first line of that book, in my family there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing, you have to stop and say, how is that? That's not the first line of a book about the West. Wait a minute, we don't talk about religion in the West. You know, that sort of thing. Though that exploration of all the variety of variousness of life, which lies outside the parameters of the mythology about the West, for instance, in the West, is a sign that suddenly the writing is beginning to become mature and to not be just a kind of pocket mythology in response to a pocket mythology of some kind or another.
I'm always interested when somebody makes a big change in their life, like you did when you sold the ranch and went to school and then became a university teacher and became a professional writer. What happens to their family? Does their family stay together? I know you were married. I think you had a child or children at the time you sold the ranch and started to write professionally. If you don't mind my asking, did your family stay together through that change?
No, it certainly did not. I think that I think everybody, you know, in terms of having agendas, and I really believe people live their lives like stories. I believe we come to recognitions and insights just like they do in stories, and we respond to those recognitions and insights. And I think that people who start off life, say it as I did when I got married to my wife at 21, sharing pretty much a view of the world, and suddenly at 35. We find out that we don't share that view of the world anymore, and we go our separate directions. That's what happened in my family. It was very, very emotionally painful. I mean, it was really, you know, I don't want to say a tragedy, but it sure hurt a lot of people's feelings. I'll put it that way. I think that happens a lot. I think that one of the things that we can do that's good for us all, which we didn't know enough to do in those days, obviously, was to objectify this whole business of coming to recognitions and insights about our life, that's what we are as human beings most often doing, is trying to understand our lives by coming to these kinds of insights and to understand that's a normal, healthy, good thing to do, that we don't have to, you know, plug our lives into one track and stay there for the rest of our life. I'm writing a book right now for Simon & Schuster called Hole in the Sky, which is about changing lives, essentially. The discussion we're having right now is is part of the argument of that book. And one of the things my editor said a long time ago, he said, I don't know about selling books about Montana or Nevada or Eastern Oregon, but he said, I do know I can sell books about people trying to make some sense out of how to manage the changes in their life, the really fundamental changes that come. And it is a very troubling process, but I think that it's a very normal process and a very necessary process if we're to, as a society and as individuals, to grow and mature and change and proceed.
We know earlier in the interview you said that you think it's time that we start telling ourselves a new story, and you were referring to the kind of exploitation that happened in the West and how it's time to create new stories about using the land without exploitation. When you make a big change in your life, do you think of it as also creating a new story, and does the story that you plan to live out occur to you before you start living it, or does the story unfold as your life begins to change?
I think both. You know, obviously, I think that when you make some major change, you probably want to have some rationale for it. You want to think you're doing something positive, that you're moving in some kind of correct direction. I think that the idea of living a new story in the West is a very necessary thing. I think it's happening. I don't think there's much any of us can do about it. It's just occurring. We're starting to understand that we have to take care of the world. We have to stay home. This is all there's going to be. There's nothing left to conquer. And, you know, if we wreck things, we're going to have to live with the wreckage, which wasn't always true in the West. You could always move on, you know, up until about 50 years ago or 40 years ago. And I think that's true in our own lives, too, that in this process of changing our lives and moving on, we need to really also be aware of damage control and not proceed with some kind of absolute heedlessness, which oftentimes we did, which I did in my middle 30s. I think I was pretty heedless. I just had this notion of what I wanted to do, and I was just, you know, heading for it, and I did, and probably hurt myself and other people.
Yeah, but you know, probably if you weren't heedless about it, you wouldn't have been able to do it.
I
mean, to make such a big change and to uproot yourself so dramatically, unless you take really drastic action and don't think too long about the consequences, it's awfully hard to do.
I agree with that completely. So I have no answer. I think you know that finally you just have to move, and you have to say, this is where I'm going and this is what I have to do, and I'm sorry, but here I go. And at that point, you just have to tip your hat and take the consequences.
So how much land do you live on now? Do you have any land?
None whatsoever. I don't have a square inch. And that's fine with me. I made a rule in my life, you know, no more lawns. And I suppose that goes back to the whole ranching business. Once there was all that land, and I feel no need for it whatsoever anymore. And that's just exercised for my life. And I love, you know, being on the land, being around the natural world, and I even love going to my friend's house and giving them advice who own pieces of property and giving them advice which they never take about what they ought to do about, you know, some farming problem. But as far as doing it myself, I feel no need to do it at all anymore.
So it's good enough to be around land. You don't have to own the land.
That's the way I feel. Yeah, and I really don't at this point anymore in my life. And this is not some you know, goofy religious principle or something. I just don't feel any urge to own it. And I'm glad to be there. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad it's when it does, I'm glad it looks good. And I hope more of it is taken care of. And that's enough. The idea that I have to own a piece of land that I can go over and dig a hole in or something is just not present in me anymore. And I don't think that makes me something. I just think that's, you know, a result of historical circumstances, my own life.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about your writing. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been William Kittredge, and his recent books include Owning It All, which is a collection of essays, and We Are Not In This Together, a collection of stories, both published by Grey Wolf Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I speak with film director and screenwriter Robert Towne. He wrote the scripts for the films Chinatown, The Last Detail, and Shampoo. He directed Personal Best, and he directed and wrote the new film Tequila Sunrise. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with writers Josephine Keynes, Gillian Kearney, Frank Shaun, Joseph Silva, Con Stephenson, Chad Calhoun, Howard Lee, and Zeke Masters. But things won't be as crowded as they might sound. All of those names are just the pen names of one person, writer Ron Gallart, a self-described Renaissance hack. Coming up, Ron Gallart talks about his latest project, a history of the pulp detective magazines. Also, in honor of composer Elliot Carter's 80th birthday, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Carter's recent recordings. And book critic Stuart Klawans reviews The Make-Believers by Barry Fleming. Stuart says the book fell through the cracks when it was first published in 1973, but you've got a second chance through a new edition. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Secretary of State George Shultz tonight announced a major development in foreign policy, saying the U.S. is ready to open a dialogue with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Shultz said the decision was a direct result of PLO leader Yasser Arafat's recognition of Israel's right to exist and acceptance of two key U.N. Security Council resolutions. The Israeli embassy reacted immediately to the U.S. announcement, issuing a statement of regret. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Israeli embassy issued a short and simple statement. It says, "We regret the U.S. decision to establish contact with the PLO. We don't consider this step an advancement of the peace process in the Middle East. Israel will continue to pursue its policy of searching for peaceful solutions to the conflict through direct negotiations with Palestinian Arabs and Jordan." End of statement. A spokesperson said the embassy would have further reaction within hours. In 1975, the U.S. agreed with Israel not to talk with the PLO unless certain conditions were met, including recognition of Israel's right to exist and adoption of two U.N. resolutions, 242 and 338. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Hundreds of mourners, many armed with M16 rifles, marched through the West Bank settlement of Baraka today to bury a Jewish settler bludgeoned to death yesterday by a Palestinian shepherd. The army blew up the shepherd's home after ordering his family to evacuate. Meanwhile, three Palestinians were deported from Israel today into Lebanon. Israeli officials say the deportations were unrelated to the year-long Palestinian unrest because two of the men were charged with crimes predating the uprising and the third was an illegal alien. George Bush today called on Clayton Yeider to be his Secretary of Agriculture. Yeider is another holdover from the Reagan cabinet, where he currently serves as U.S. Trade Representative. NPR's John Idstey has details.
Yeider has served three administrations in the areas of trade and agriculture since coming to Washington and was reportedly anxious to return to private life. According to associates, he had many lucrative offers from private industry, offers which Yeider suggested were difficult to ignore.
It wasn't easy, I can assure you, but public service is a high privilege in this country, and public service at this level is a particularly high privilege.
Part of the reason Yeider was pursued so aggressively by Bush may be Yeider's ability to provide some continuity in important trade negotiations in agriculture. Many people believe that the success of the current round of worldwide trade talks depends on an agreement on agricultural subsidies. Yeider has been the chief U.S. negotiator in those talks, and keeping him involved as agriculture secretary will help the Bush administration hit the ground running. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
The merchandise trade deficit in October fell by more than 3% from the month before. The Commerce Department said today the U.S. trade gap dropped to $10.3 billion. It's the second consecutive monthly decline, but many analysts were unimpressed, noting fluctuations over the past several months have left the deficit essentially flat. In a separate report, the Federal Reserve Board said that the operating rate at U.S. factories, mines, and utilities rose 0.2% last month to just over 84%, the highest level in 9 years. That report is likely to intensify concern about inflation. As factory use edges toward 85%, economists fear manufacturers will have trouble producing enough goods to meet demand. That could lead to shortages and price increases. The head of the United Nations peacekeeping operations issued a new appeal today for the release of Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins, kidnapped while on UN duty in Lebanon. The appeal by Merak Goulding came at public ceremonies marking the award of the Nobel Peace Prize to the UN peacekeepers. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 9 points to close at 21.34.25. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This past Sunday, American composer Elliot Carter celebrated his 80th birthday. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of some of Carter's recordings. The albums are recent, but the works they feature are not. Here's an excerpt from the composer's Piano Concerto from 1965.
Even a composer as valued as Elliot Carter still has a hard time getting his works recorded. The latest album to include anything by Carter is an American song recital on the Nonesuch label by mezzo-soprano Jan de Gaetani and pianist Gilbert Kalish, two of Carter's most devoted advocates. It's a useful and revealing selection of songs, ranging from Stephen Foster to this year's Pulitzer Prize winner, William Baulkham. The Carter songs are the most delightful pieces on the album, settings of two Robert Frost poems, The Rose Family and Dust of Snow, composed in 1942. Here's Dust of Snow. It's been 2 years since the last important Carter release. New World Records issued brilliant performances by Michael Gielen and the Cincinnati Symphony of two of Carter's most ambitious orchestral works, The Variations for Orchestra, composed in 1955, and The Piano Concerto from 1965. Pianist Ursula Oppens plays it here with phenomenal virtuosity and delicacy. But Carter did not stop composing in 1965, or 1975, or even 1985. His major new works, an oboe concerto commissioned by Heinz Holliger, an enigmatic chamber piece called Penthode, and his fourth string quartet, the deepest and most beautiful of his later masterpieces, have yet to be released. One of the most interesting things about Carter is the continuity of his career. A first hearing of these recordings would suggest hardly any connection between Carter's pretty and playful Frost miniatures and the two massive, intricate, and exhausting orchestral works. Yet the more you listen, the more they do seem the work of the same composer. Even as early as 1942, in fact even earlier, Carter was already taking daring harmonic leaps and characteristically setting off one kind of rhythmic pulse against another. An impulse that led to his exciting explorations in what he called metrical modulation. Since his later works seem to have abandoned anything we might ordinarily call melody, it's refreshing and reassuring to hear that he had a gift for irresistible tunes. Like discovering that an abstract expressionist painter could draw a convincing figure or beautiful landscape. Once you know that he actually wrote tunes, you begin to hear them everywhere, no matter how disguised or fractured they might be, as in this passage from The Variations.
Thank you.
Let's close with Carter's The Rose Family, his witty and affectionate setting of Frost's affectionate parody of Gertrude Stein's A Rose is a Rose is a Rose. I'll read the words first, then imagine that Janda Gaetani is singing them to Elliot Carter on his 80th birthday. The rose is a rose and was always a rose. But the theory now goes that the apple's a rose, and the pear is, and so's the plum, I suppose. The deer only knows what will next prove a rose. You, of course, are a rose, but we're always a rose.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Earl Stanley Gardner, and John D. MacDonald got their start writing detective stories for cheap, popular magazines known as pulps. These magazines, with such titles as Black Mask, Dime Detective, and Thrilling Detective, flourished in the 20s and 30s before dying out by the mid-50s. Ron Gallard's new book, The Dime Detectives, is a history of these pulps. Gallard is a prolific writer of mysteries and science fiction. He also spent many years working in advertising. Perhaps you remember his newspaper parody that appeared on Rice and Wheatchex boxes in the 60s. Ron Gallard told me how the pulps got their name.
Basically, from the kind of cheap paper they're printed on, it's called wood pulp or pulpwood paper, and they used to be called, you know, pulpwood magazines, and eventually they just shortened it to pulps. And in the heyday of the magazines in the 20s and 30s, of course, the opposite of the pulps was the slicks, like the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, which paid the big money.
The slicks would be the equivalent of the glossies.
Glossy now, yeah.
Did hard-boiled detective fiction start in the pulps?
Pretty much, yeah, in the 1920s. After the First World War, there was that kind of cynical, jaded kind of thing that spread across the whole of the United States and probably the whole world. People were disillusioned, and they sort of, in a way, acted a lot tougher maybe than they were. So you get that blending of acting tough and really being sentimental underneath it. And also there was a great deal of interest in the American language at that time and slang. You had people like Ring Lardner and Mencken writing about slang and Lardner writing in vernacular and so forth.
You say that Black Mask, one of the pulp magazines, changed the mystery field for good. How?
Well, Black Mask was the one, halfway by chance, in a way, that introduced writers like, particularly Dashiell Hammett and later Raymond Chandler, and they started writing in a different way, and that was they started writing about the mean streets and the gangsters and the drifters and the private detectives who really worked, you know, on crimes that were sort of tabloid newspaper crimes as opposed to crimes where people worked out ingenious ways of murdering somebody with poison. These were people who shot people in an alley, and this kind of thing began to get into Black Mask. And by the 1930s, it pretty much had taken over a great many of the magazines because people related to it.
Well, this magazine, Black Mask, was co-founded by H.L. Mencken, and by theater critic George Nathan.
Yeah.
That surprised me.
Well, Menken, as he says, and as I quote, he was looking to make some money. He wasn't doing that well. Now, Menken had started a magazine called Smart Set, and that was the one they hoped to make the money on, and I guess they needed some more financing, so they decided that the best thing they could sell would be a book of detective stories, a monthly magazine. And it was quite successful for them, even before it turned to a hard-boiled magazine, when it was just giving the same old kind of very polite detective stories.
You reprint an example of some of the very stiff early writing that appeared in Black Mask magazine. Can I ask you to read an example of that?
Yeah, all right. Now, I've got to make sure here I'm not reading my own stuff when we want stiff writing here. Oh, no, here it is. When Mr. George Mitchell propped the news against the sugar bowl and dug into his matutinal grapefruit, he was unused to interruptions by persons answering classified advertisements. But on this particular morning, the maid casually remarked that there was someone at the door inquiring for a position as chauffeur. That's got a lot of things in it. Very obviously upper class, long sentences with semicolons, and also people who are hiring chauffeurs and have maids and so forth. This was the kind of thing that a great many... What is still one of the major categories of detective stories, particularly in England, which is the country house kind of thing, where everybody has servants and it's an all very upper class kind of thing. Hammett and Chandler and Carol John Daly and people like that began writing about different kinds of crimes, you know, more urban, big town American kind of crimes, and those involved, as I said, shooting and robbery and hijacking and all kinds of things like that.
Why do the pulps start dying out?
People give different dates on that. It started after the Second World War. In 1945-46, they began to dwindle, and by the middle 1950s, almost all of them were gone. And the reasons for that were the encroachment of two things, the paperback novel and the television, which ate up almost everybody's leisure time.
Were there still pulps around when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I never sold to a pulp magazine. But somewhere in one of my trunks, I do have several rejection slips. But I was trying to sell the science fiction pulps. I never sent to a detective pulp.
Why not?
I wanted to be exclusively a sci-fi writer in those days. And it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I started sending out detective stories, branched out.
What did you read when you were growing up?
Everything that I could find, anything that was printed, you know, even the labels on the soup cans or something. I just liked to read. And I read comic books first, and... In my drugstore, everything was graded, you know, for your age. Way down toward the floor were the comics, and then above them were the pulps, and then above them eventually were the paperbacks. So you just kind of worked your way up, you know. So I started with, I read every comic book that came out from about 1938 onward, and then I got into science fiction pulps. There was Planet Stories and Thrilling Wonder Stories. I mean, you couldn't resist a title like that, Startling Stories. And I began to discover people like Ray Bradbury and John D. MacDonald, and I thought they were terrific. And that kind of really pulled me into the science fiction field for a long time.
In some ways, I think of you as being an old-fashioned writer, and by that I mean...
Yes, sure.
Yeah, you write everything. You write science fiction, you write detective novels. You've written under many, many pseudonyms. You've written novelizations of films, including Cleopatra Jones. You've written novelizations of comic strips, including Vampirella. Novelizations of TV shows, including Laverne and Shirley.
Yes, that was a classic.
You've written romance novels?
Yes.
As well? You like working in all these different forms, the best way to make a living?
What I define myself as sort of a Renaissance hack. I mean, in other words, anytime... Well, yeah, I mean, this is what I do for a living, you know. I'm not one of these guys, you know, who has a job or something. So if somebody, it's not so bad now. It used to be years ago. I mean, having lunch with an editor, and she had bought, let's say, two of my science fiction novels, and then all of a sudden her company decided to kill science fiction at that particular house for a couple of years. And I'd say, well, what the hell else can I do? And she said, have you ever written a Regency romance? I said, what is it? You know, and she said, well, it takes place, you know, in England and during the Regency, and I had to find out what that was. And so I wrote a couple of them and sold them to her. So, yeah, sometimes it's expediency that makes one, do more than one kind of genre.
How come you don't write all these genre books under your own name?
I would, because my ego is such that I'd say I'd love it. But somebody pointed out to me once, if you see 14 books by somebody in the same year, you begin to think maybe the guy's, you know, stretching himself too far.
And aren't you, though? Or are you?
This is a double-edged question because, I have slowed down. I only do at most 6 books a year now, so it's not the writing that's the difficult part. It's the plotting of the book. Once you got the structure, I can write a book, I shouldn't tell my editors this, I can write a book in a month or 6 weeks. If you do 10 pages a day, you can theoretically write a small book in 20 days. Or 3 weeks, and that gives you a day off. See?
Now, some of the pseudonyms that you've written under are called house pseudonym. Why don't you explain what a house pseudonym is?
Well, that goes back to the pulps or before. I guess it goes back to the dime novels where, you know, they had a series and they wanted, let's say, 12 books or 24 books a year about this character, and they thought no one human being could do that. So instead of driving Bert L. Standish or whoever to death, they got three guys, or like Nick Carter, they got three people or 10 people to be Nick Carter, and that's how they got the material. So I've done two or three things like that where there was a series established at a paperback house, and they wanted, particularly with the Westerns, they were doing at one point 24 of them a year, and they didn't think the guy that created it could do it, so they brought in two other writers. And we were, what the hell was that? Was Zeke Masters was the pen name. And we were going to start a club once called the Zeke Masters Writers of America. And, you know, like we had five of us that were Zeke Masters and so forth. But mostly it's their wish. In other words, they want everybody to think that Kenneth Robeson or Zeke Masters or whoever, Chad Calhoun, I think was one of them, that there's only one person doing that. I must tell you, this goes, as you may already know, this goes on at very high levels. I mean, there are many, many, or some anyway, major books by writers who have nothing to do with them. They just put their name on them, you know. But that's another whole topic.
So what are you working on now? What books?
I'm supposed to be right this minute working on a mystery novel for St. Martin's. It's called The Tijuana Bible. And it's about people looking for $1 million worth of rare comic books. And that's due in a few weeks, and I hope to God that I'll be able to finish it. I'm behind on that. I'm also editing something which will be called the Encyclopedia of American Comic Book, American Comics, excuse me, which will cover comic books and comic strips in America.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you for talking with me.
Ron Gillard's new book, The Dime Detectives, is published by Mysterious Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, George Bush made a new appointment to his cabinet today.
Yes, he did. He named his agriculture secretary. It's Clayton Yeater, who has been the U.S. Special Trade Representative for President Reagan, yet another senior Reagan administration official who will continue in the new Bush administration.
What else are you covering?
Well, we have a special report from Sandy Tolan on the Navajo-Hopi land dispute in the Southwest. And we'll also be hearing about an Immigration Naturalization Service crackdown on Nicaraguans who are in this country and who now will have a harder time staying.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When you hear that a novel has been published by a small press, you might think it's too offbeat for a big publishing house, or maybe just not that good. But critic Stuart Klawan says Barry Fleming's novel, The Make-Believers, was the kind of book any big house might have been proud to publish, though none of them did. But Stuart says that's not the end of this story.
Why don't they write good, old-fashioned novels anymore? The kind of big, leisurely novel you can get lost in for a couple of weeks, so you know the characters as well as your own family. Why don't they write them like that? The truth is, they do. It's just that sometimes the books aren't published. Consider what happened to Barry Fleming. He's been a respected writer for half a century, a novelist with a good reputation among critics, and a pretty good sales record. Bestsellers, book club contracts, movie deals. So in 1973, when he wrote The Make-Believers, he might have expected just a little attention. He had turned 73, and The Make-Believers looked like the summation of his whole career. But the big publishers didn't care. Fleming managed to publish his book only with a small press in Georgia that rarely handles novels, a press that specializes in cookbooks and travel guides. The Make-Believers disappeared with barely a trace. Was there anything wrong with the book? Just the opposite. The Make-Believers is a long, satisfying, subtle book about two generations of a Southern family, from the period before World War I up to the 1950s. It's full of carefully observed details, from the sights and sounds of old railroads and trolley cars to the intricate code of manners between white people and black. You can find some precisely rendered chunk of reality, some well-turned phrase, bringing the story to life on just about every page. And it's a pretty good story on top of that. It begins with a murder. Two white men have been clubbed to death on a farm outside a small Georgia town. The sheriff has arrested a black farmhand and is holding him in the town jail, though not carefully enough to prevent a lynching. While all the black people disappear from the streets, the white citizens start to gather around. And that's when Ike Woodruff steps in. He's the congressman for the town, a politician who plays at being folksy in order to get votes, and doesn't care for a minute whether the black man is innocent or guilty. Ike just doesn't want to have a lynching in his district. It would make him look bad with his friends up in Washington. So he steps in, just enough to fool the mob into going home. He thinks that's the end of it. But of course, it's just the beginning. Ike, almost against his will, winds up defending the man. And that's the start of a knot of relationships among Ike, his half-brother the Bohemian painter, their friend the town doctor, and the doctor's Boston-born wife. Some parts of these relationships are better realized than others, but in over 400 closely written pages, you never feel the author is delivering less than an elegantly written, deeply thoughtful story. And now another small press has delivered something to the author, Second Chance Press, which specializes in reprinting neglected books, has reissued The Make-Believers and is bringing out all of Fleming's other novels as well. The editor of Second Chance Press is also going to bring out a new novel by Barry Fleming in February, a novel Fleming has just finished writing at age 89. Until then, you can get The Make-Believers by Barry Fleming at your bookstore, or write to Second Chance Press, Noyack Road, Sag Harbor, New York, 11963. If you didn't have a pencil the first time, it's Second Chance Press, Noyack Road, Sag Harbor, New York, 11963.
Stuart Klawans writes about the small press and film for The Nation. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with detective novelist Joseph Hansen. Hansen's main character, Dave Branstetter, is an oddity in the world of hard-boiled detective fiction. He's a death claims investigator who happens to be gay. Stand-up comics have been called the rock stars of the 80s. Our rock critic Ken Tucker takes a closer look with reviews of new comedy albums by Sam Kinison, Dennis Miller, and Will Durst. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mississippi Burning, the story of the murders of three civil rights workers in 1964 and the FBI investigation that followed. It stars Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.